Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much to all of our listeners all over the world, and especially over the last few weeks in the United States and Canada and New Zealand, Australia and Sweden, Russia and Ireland. Always fascinating. Please be in touch. It is really good also to know that there are people all over the world who find that this podcast speaks to them. What is also really powerful about that is that there are a number of people who have been in contact with each other who are fans of the podcast and who have met each other from being fellow fans. And that is really lovely. It's always nice to know that while this podcast was really initially to help provide education and prevention, it also seems to be providing connection, and I love that. And so for today, we have Diana Nowak, and she's had quite the experience or experiences. She's a survivor of the infamous troubled teen institution known as the Academy at Ivy Ridge. She's featured in the recently released Netflix docuseries, The Program, Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping, which specifically covers the Academy at Ivy Ridge. The series, directed by Catherine Kubler, exposes the corruption and abuse of the troubled teen industry through the stories of Diana and her fellow survivors, who are unfortunately, but understandably, still haunted by their experiences. Diana, now an advocate for survivors with the Breaking Code Silence organization, still remembers all the horrors from her 2 years at Ivy Ridge, from forced medication and unconsenting strip searches to the rotting smell of the dormitories. She's now speaking out to make sure the public knows her story is unfortunately not unique, but just one of the thousands of stories of TTI, troubled teen industry survivors. She's here today to help foster the healing of survivors and their families by speaking up about her own harrowing experience. Here is Diana now. I am really pleased to have Diana Nowak with me, who I've been wanting to talk to for a long time, because I think it is so important that you are talking about what happened to you so openly. I'm sure it's hard. I'm sure it's hard to just have to get into the memories and the stories and just reading your story. And it's been incredible. And the fact that there is now something on Netflix about your experience, about other people's experience, with really important footage about what can happen. Because sometimes words don't land in the way that we want, but to have the visuals, the really disturbing and really important to expose kinds of visuals, is really, really important, because otherwise it just stays in the shadows. So I would love you to take a moment to introduce yourself, and then we will start talking.
Hi, I'm Diana. Super excited to be here and talking with you. In early March, the Program documentary came out on Netflix, and we had been filming that for a few years, and I was super excited and nervous. I had gone out to LA to see the premiere of the first episode, but I had not seen the last two episodes. So it was a really exciting day. And yeah, I'm featured in it as, from what I've been told, the girl who staff tried to break down to get me to conform to the program. So I think that's probably what I'm best known for in there.
Right. So I think it is really quite incredible that there is this this story that people have that is so disturbing, that is so out there at times, but they kind of go about their daily life. Like someone meeting you today wouldn't know what you've necessarily been through. And I think people find a way to adjust to it, to hide it, to sort of figure out where to put it. And so I think it is really important then for people to know the resiliency that they're seeing when they meet you and you're, you know, you have it together after all that you've been through.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's really, it's an important thing also to know that you have it in yourself to kind of pull it together and come across as together and professional and all of it, because that also helps you be taken seriously, you know, like if you're trying to change laws, if you're trying to change what's happening out there, it's so that you can kind of stay calm enough to tell your story. I'm sure that's not been easy for you. I mean, that's not easy for a lot of people.
Yeah, I would say in just the context of the documentary, Catherine, the director, was incredibly inspiring. Just with her going back into her own story. I mean, she was going into old footage, conversations with her family, letters. She probably was one of the bigger inspirations just in my life in general, but also in facing this and talking about it. She was very like, the entire set was a safe space and everybody was like trauma informed. So it was a very safe place to share my story. And luckily, like, and she's just so kind to talk to. And then also the other survivors, them coming forward with their stories was very inspiring as well to me and motivating and helped me feel more comfortable in talking about my own experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, sometimes when people talk to me about why I decided to start this podcast, one of the reasons was because I remember hearing people say, I don't want to be the first person and I don't want to be the only person who's coming forward. I mean, especially people who've been involved in cults, people who've been in some of these teen treatment places where they've been put on the hot seat. They're terrified of being the person who seems to be speaking out against something, or even if they're not speaking out against, they're just telling the truth and what that's going to do to you. So hearing other people tell their stories is really very empowering and can help you feel a little more safeguarded that you're one of many, which feels really, really nice. I know having a lot of people on here who have dealt with being in some of these residential places has been really good for people to hear. Even people who haven't experienced it are really touched by people's stories. And there's something I mentioned a while back on the podcast that I want to mention again here before hearing more about just your story, is that people might think this is something that happens in other places or that used to happen more, you know, years and years ago, and now they've learned and, you know, they don't do it anymore. I was recently working with a family where they felt like their daughter was really out of control here in Los Angeles. And they went to their school and the school counselor gave them a number of these people who have this whole resource list of different places that they could send their daughter, all of which were going to be ensuring, unfortunately, that the daughter was going to be kidnapped in the middle of the night and taken to a place, and it was going to cost a lot of money for the parents, but this was the best option and the only option. And when the parents came to me to tell me about how this was going to happen and that because these people had degrees in education, but they were making money off of sending people to these places, they were still doing it. They're still sending people there, which was unconscionable, especially if you have a degree and you should know better. Really, in total, but they had kind of talked themselves into making it seem okay because they believed the justifications about why that was necessary and how it was beneficial. And here, very reasonable parents were saying, but I'm sure it'll be fine and she'll be better and, you know, everything will somehow be forgiven and forgotten. And I guess they read the look on my face.
I know I make probably the same face because I know exactly.
Right? Right? And they said, well, it's, you know, when they said, oh, she'll, you know, she'll, everything will be forgiven and forgotten. And then they saw my face and one of the parents said, or not. Like they sort of knew, like, mm-mm. I said, let me tell you a little bit about this. And shame on them for making you feel like this is your only option. Meanwhile, she needed a therapist. She needed someone to talk to. She was going through her own thing at school. Once that was resolved, she had a learning disability that went undiagnosed. She needed support and she's fine. She didn't need to be sent anywhere. You know, I mean, sometimes the problem can be solved if you just spend time really getting to know the person and what they're struggling with, as opposed to just being punitive and deciding to send them away and punish them in some way. So I think just knowing that this still exists around us without safeguards makes it all the more important for you to be telling your story. And so I'd love for the listeners to hear more about you, but tell us a little bit about you.
Sure. Well, I know I didn't dive too much into kind of my story before the program, the actual program, the boarding Ivy Ridge. And I think I really liked that Catherine did that. Like, we didn't share any background stories because the focus was on, it doesn't matter what the child does. There is never a justification. Anything a child could do that would warrant being sent to one of these places and being abused, there's nothing. So no matter what anyone's story is before being sent to Ivy Ridge or any of the other schools or wilderness programs, really in the end doesn't matter, just because even though it does, it's a good place to start healing, like you were saying, with the person when you got to know them and kind of maybe got to the root of if they had trauma or what was going on in their lives. But yeah, nothing that any of us did would ever warrant what we experienced having that happen to us. With that said, I can definitely explain what led me to Ivy Ridge. So we did talk about my father passing away when I was very young. We were T-boned by a car. I think they were going incredibly fast. We're T-boned and we rolled numerous times and landed upside down. And my father passed away and my mother had a very serious head injury. She hit the one side of the car and then bounced back and hit my dad's head. So she had a very serious injury. And I remember everything. Like, it was, to this day, clear as day. I remember everything that happened. I remember the way everything sounded. I remember the screaming. I remember what was said right before the car hit us, everything. So in these very traumatic, stressful times, a lot of people tend to dissociate, which is your body's way of keeping you safe. And my mother had a very serious head injury. And because of that, she had a very hard time taking care of me. And understandably, she lost the love of her life in that car accident. And she also had to cope with the head injury, which I don't know if you've had any experience knowing anyone, but it really can change your personality. It kind of changes your fuse, how short your fuse is. So it was terrible what happened to her. And I was also dealing with the trauma of what I saw. So that kind of led me to, I wouldn't necessarily say, of some form of acting out because I felt so misunderstood, but also kind of some issues with authority because I felt that I had seen and I knew too much at such a young age. And I felt that I had everything ripped away from me. My childhood, my happiness. Yeah, I just felt in a really arrogant way wiser than everybody, especially authority. So like teachers, things like that. So I didn't really know I don't think my mom knew either how to deal with that. So yeah, and it kind of continued as I got older. And then a lot of, you know, not wanting to be at home, not wanting to be at school, kind of just getting into trouble, really hanging out with the wrong crowd. And, you know, just general, I always say general sassiness that I had back then. But I think the sickest thing that this program did to my mother was they, of course, will take advantage of anyone for commission, basically, or a kickback. And I think what the sickest part of this in my mom's story was that she had a head injury. And so she wasn't really capable of making the most straight decisions. And they knew that. So when I received my file back, I found multiple copies of my father's death certificate. They convinced her to send her my dad's death certificate, talk about like the court case. So it was very bizarre. They were definitely pulling strings with her, but she just wasn't in the best place to be making those kinds of decisions at that time. And they knew that, but they didn't care because I was just a dollar sign to them. So it was pretty sick.
That is really sick to take advantage of that, right? Because you're supposed to be of sound mind, right? When you sign a legal document and they're supposed to assess for that. And if they just didn't care and they were just hoping to try to find a way to get her signature and to have her also send very private things. Yeah. And that is really, really incredible. And so I want you to pick it up from there. I just want to say something to underscore what you were talking about, how it doesn't matter what you did that led up to this. And it's really true. As a therapist, what I care about are the before and after pieces, the why. Why you were doing what you were doing, to understand you and to support you and to clarify things for you about the world, and suddenly having something happen that's so shocking that rips so much from you that you couldn't control, and the impact that that can have. And then the other side, how you were treated in response to what you were doing. Because yeah, if we focus on what you were doing that led to you being abused, it's like asking a woman who's raped what she was wearing, you know, like none of that matters. And let's get to the things that really do matter here. And it's not about you at all. Okay. Yeah. So then you found your file. That's really alarming. Okay. So let's pick that up from there. Where were you wanting to go with your story?
So, yeah, I mean, I would just say that's why I got sent away. I luckily had a really supportive friend group from an early age. So they were pretty confused all the times I would disappear because I went to multiple. I went to two different boarding schools. So, but luckily I had an outside support system and still do, which is wonderful. In addition to every, like Catherine and Alexa and everyone, Allison in the documentary, who's just been an amazing support. But it's wild because when we were in the program, we were all pitted against each other. And that was kind of the mind game that they did, part of the brainwashing. And that was pretty hard. So to have us all come together now, I think is so special. And I hope, just like getting my story out there at all, that it first of all validates survivors, because I wouldn't say that I wasn't believed for 20 years. I think that you had said in the beginning, you can only say something and it impacts someone so much. You have to see it. And I know, like, people would ask me questions. I would kind of, usually if I didn't want to, like, just go into it, and I wouldn't really tell a lot of new people that I met. I'd want them to know me first and know me as an honest person and like a good person before I told them, oh, I was a, you know, considered a troubled teen. So, but usually I would say I went to this private boarding school, and I did that for a long time. But when I would open up about it, they would just stare at me blankly and be like, that's insane. Like, how could someone do that to you? How could someone say that you should die in a car accident and your father live, and the world would be better for that? And there was some shock to that, but also I think there was discomfort where you go next with that conversation. Also, I could tell my emotions or explain them, but it really wasn't doing enough, I think. In 2020, Paris Hilton came out with her documentary where she talked about the programs and her experience with them. So that kickstarted the whole movement. That's when I first really came out with my story and started sharing a lot of it.
Right. Two things. One is that people are really careful. And I know with the people I work with, they're really careful about how much they share with people and with whom and when. And they don't want to flood someone and overwhelm someone with more information than they're going to know what to do with. But still, there is this kind of weird and really unfortunate thing that happens where the information that you're sharing seems to land back on you. And when you say that you went to a troubled teen place, they're going to see you as the troubled thing, not the place. And right. And then I think once someone's reputation is messed with, it's really hard to get it back. And you don't want to be the one to be coming across a certain way, affecting your own reputation with someone where you don't know what they're going to do with that information. And if they're just going to say, well, you know, she just probably was problematic and she just didn't like that she was being kept from acting out or whatever sort of justification that people have at the ready, unfortunately, too often, just because they want to make sense of this in their mind and they shut off listening and really understanding. And you've probably come across that.
Yeah. And I think also what was hard for me, especially, I had some really bad experiences after the car accident, getting help, like a therapist and things like that. After the car accident, I basically stopped sleeping because I was having flashbacks at night when I'd be sleeping. So I would keep myself awake. I think that exacerbated my issue. So my insomnia got really bad. You know, my mom did everything she could. She had me seeing a therapist, and that kind of progressed over the years, seeing different therapists, specialists, to try to deal with that problem and just kind of what I was going through. And then the program basically weaponized therapy. They used actual, literal, like proven techniques, like in therapy and psychology. And there's so much truth to healing your inner child. I know that, like in all the work I've done since then, there's so much truth into healing the little girl or little, you know, person who's inside you. And I think a lot of the survivors are having a really, maybe not so much now because the documentary came out, so they're more open to talking about it, but it was hard for us to get therapy and talk to somebody about it because we were abused in the name of therapy. So that, I would say, it just keeps, like, all these hits keep coming against us, the survivors. It's just, there's no help out there. Nobody understands, you know, nobody really gets it. And then there's therapists who we're afraid of or are immediately kind of closed off to. And yeah, so I am very lucky. I feel like I have found some incredible people who have helped me in my journey. I've learned DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, loved it. And I actually use that now when I tutor students in English and writing, and a lot of them have like test anxiety, social anxiety, and I use the DBT skills. So kind of passing that on. But I think DBT should be taught in like grade school. I think everybody would benefit from it. But that was a form of therapy that I was open to. But I understand that for a lot of survivors, it's really scary and it's just feels like a hostile environment, even though it's supposed to be a safe space.
Right. I'm curious to hear if you can give some examples of DBT therapy that was helpful to you and also how you use it with other students now.
Oh, yeah. So I use with my students self-soothe kits. So when you need to ground yourself, whether that's a perfume or a photograph or something you can play with in your hands, like a fidget spinner or slime, anything, and something to take you kind of out of the emotional state that you're in and ground you is really important. I feel like that helps with focus as well. And then also not taking things personally. You know, if somebody is angry with you, chances are that they probably have something going on in their life or like something's upsetting them. So usually if I have anyone be like mean to me now, like since learning DBT, if someone's mean, I'm just like, okay, I ask them, I'm like, what's going on? Like, you know, like why are you so angry right now? Am I triggering you? Like, is there something? So I don't take a lot of things personally anymore. And it also prevents me from being in any way impulsive. I don't feel like I am an impulsive person, but it definitely helped me learn how to take my time, make decisions, and choose my path that I'm going to take in dealing with things and going with that.
That's great. That's really, really great. There was someone who was on the podcast, and I wound up talking about this at the end of a show or two, who said something so powerful about how there was this behavior that she was engaging in that was because she was traumatized, but she felt like she couldn't talk about the trauma. And so people were just dealing with the behavior, and she was, you know, being sent to all these places. And really what she wanted was exactly as you're saying, she just wanted someone to stop and say, is everything okay?
Yes, exactly. You know, I
like,
agree.
Can we talk, and to make it safe to talk about whatever's on their mind instead of you've been this bad kid and you need to be punished for this, which just sends you down a whole other road, right? But just to have someone put their arm around you physically or emotionally and say, like, I'm here. Can I help in some way? What's on your mind? You know?
Yes, I agree. I just felt like I grew up in the time when the new thing was tough love. And that was really becoming like a standard practice, I think, for parents. And I don't agree with it. I definitely don't think that's the way at all. I think the harder you try to like keep a child down and like put all these rules and restrictions and things like that and try to suppress their creativity or their personality and not foster it, I think that chances are that the child will rebel in some way.
Right. I remember getting into, I wouldn't call them fights as much as disagreements, even with my former partner, but also with people who were fellow parents, where they were being taught to let children cry themselves to sleep. And I remember thinking, okay, well, yeah, you want to help them learn how to self-soothe, but they have the ability to cry for a reason. And so maybe you can let it happen for a minute or two, but at some point, go in there and see what they need. And it could be an easy fix. It could be something they can't do for themselves, like change their own diaper, you know? And so just find out if they're okay and don't feel like you have to do tough love, because that ends up really being abandoning, I think.
Yeah. I think with parenting, just that from my experience and from what I have seen being successful for other people, is that when something happens as a kid, it's so upsetting. And instead of, you know, the parent disciplining or, you know, kind of saying like, figure it out, like do it, you know, like tough cookies, you know, whatever they say. I like that. I always felt like you should, as a parent, what I like to do, or no, I'm not a parent, but with like any of my students or anything, was just kind of talk to them and look them in the eye, like get down and like at eye level and be like, okay, I understand you're lost right now and you don't know how to deal with this situation emotionally. So let's do this together. And that way I'll teach you what to do next time. So when you're confronted with this issue again, you'll have the tools that you need because we did this together the first time. And I think that that's really important for an adult to do with a child. Instead of, you know, kind of saying like, oh, figure it out, or, you know, they're going to learn the hard way and things like that, which is what I got a lot. I feel like a lot of people are like, she'll learn the hard way, you know. But just saying, you know, let's do this together. I'm here for you. I support you. Let's figure this out. Let's come up with some solutions together. So then when you're confronted with this at another point, you know what to do.
Right. It's reminding me, though, I was a school counselor for many years, and I remember going in classrooms and trying to see what was happening that was great, but also what was happening that was problematic. And it was exactly that at times, that a child would be getting bothered by another kid. They'd go up to the teacher. The teacher would say, "Stop tattling." Okay, that was the first thing. That was a mistake, because it's not the person, the kid is saying, "I need help with this." But just be accused that you're doing something wrong and go sit down, that doesn't help at all. But I heard that a lot. Well, go deal with it, or, you know, figure it out. And I'm not here to tell you how to do everything. Like, there was this punitive part, like, basically you're on your own. And I thought, what? They're five, you know?
How are they going to learn otherwise?
Right. How about instead of, you know, you being worried that you're going to tell them their whole life and you're going to now be in charge of their life forever, take them aside and say, here are some choices. Here are some options. Here are some words that you can use. How can I help with having that conversation with the person who's bothering you? And then maybe next time you can have the conversation by yourself. But modeling and offering ideas, and not just like, buddy, you're on your own with your fruit roll up, right? Because you're an adult somehow, right? So anyway, but I want to go back to something that I heard you say about how you were told, among other things, I'm sure among a lot of other things, that the world would have been a better place if you were the one who had died instead of your father. Just to get to that place where you feel it's okay somehow to tell that to a child who's also been traumatized, right? So what else stays with you as some of these unbelievably harsh and cruel things that you were told that you probably had to undo in your own mind when you were leaving and see like what was true and what wasn't?
I had a lot told to me. I was told that I was garbage. I was told, you know, I was a mistake. I was told that I was the problem. No one else. It was solely my fault. I needed to be accountable for my terrible life. But I will say that these things are very, and they do come back to me every now and then. Like, if, you know, if I'm having a bad day, I get this little thing, this little voice that says, you kind of deserve it. Like, you deserve this. Like, this is, and I have to fight that a lot. I also think that a trauma response was trying to stay busy all the time. Like, what I can do next, what, anything to keep my brain occupied. So I didn't have to think about these things that were said to me. There is a little bit of a part of being told these things, you know, you're a mistake, you're, your mom would have been happier if you had died and not her husband. And I just distinctly remember being told these things during, and I can definitely tell you about this lifeboat process that we had to do.
Yes. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. I want to hear all about that. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. The good part about the things that were said to me, and yes, they do come back to me, especially when I'm having a bad day or I feel really bad about myself, but I'm really happy with little Diana because I would laugh. I remember they would say these things and I would just be like, what are you talking about? I was three. I couldn't drive. Like, just, I'm like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Literally the stupidest thing. And the problem with that is I actually didn't think about that. Maybe I shouldn't have had that reaction so much, even though that, I mean, it was dumb what they were saying, because that kind of incentivized them and egged them on to be meaner. So they didn't like that they were being laughed at. So they really did even more and more and said more upsetting things to try to break me. And like I said, those things have stayed with me for sure. But luckily at the time, I felt like I had a little bit of a win at laughing at them when they would say these things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that you could laugh is really, really important. And yeah, no, they're going to hate that. For sure.
Yeah, they did not like that.
Right. But thank goodness that you felt clear enough in your own body, your own mind, to be able to know how over the top and ridiculous that was, even though some of it will still sink in, the fact, though, that here you're laughing, which is a way for you to have self-protection. That's armor you were putting on. And then they're going to give you a harder time because you're trying to protect yourself. It's like people I know who are being hit and they put their arm up to protect themselves physically. And then they're told they're being the aggressive ones because they put their arm up. And you're thinking, no, this, like with you laughing, this was my way of protecting me from you abusing me. And now you're going to abuse me more because I'm trying to protect myself. I mean, it's like there's no way out. I'm sure it felt that way a lot.
There wasn't a right thing to do. I felt like then you can see how a lot of the things they did to us and said to us have manifested as we've gotten older. Because, you know, all of us survivors connecting, like so many, they're so such wonderful people. So like very wise, so much insight, so kind and caring. But we all kind of like struggle with the same thing about putting a lot of weight on what people say to us. I really care about looking and being accomplished. I always want to like take on a challenge. I always want to like prove to people that I'm worth it, you know, and some form of that might be, I'm literally still trying to prove that I'm not a mistake, that I do deserve to be here. I didn't want to lose my dad. This is how it happened. And I want to show them that you were wrong. I was supposed to be here. It'd be nice if we were all here from the car accident, but I do think that, yeah, some of my behaviors now do come from that specific lifeboat process and words that were said to me.
Right. Yeah. And I want to get into the lifeboat process because I also know there's a whole program called Lifeboat, which is for...
Really? Oh, goodness.
Yeah, which is equally problematic for a lot of reasons, and also because it's tied in with this kind of way of working with people. It's for addiction. But anyway, I think the idea that you are still grappling with needing to feel worthy and deserving and not deserving of bad things happening is something that happens a lot after you've been traumatized and also after you've been in a cultic system where they thought it was their job and their right to break you down. Anyone saying to anyone else that they're a mistake, anyone saying to anyone else that they deserve to die, I feel like if there's anyone not deserving of good things in that picture, it's the person who's purposely really being cruel to someone else, knowingly being cruel to someone else. All you were trying to do was make it through the day. And it is very cruel to do any of that to you. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to take the words deserving and mistake even out of your vocabulary, because there really is no such thing, right? Because people are born and then they're here and then they're deserving of good things because they're alive. And, you know, because they're equally deserving just like anyone else. That's not the way certain people are seen. Certain races are seen. Certain genders are seen. So, you know, there's a whole caste system where people are seen in different ways. But in your life, there's simply nothing that you did except you were reacting to a trauma, which means that you were trying to survive and you were trying to figure out how to help yourself feel okay in this world, because suddenly your world was literally turned upside down over and over, right? So, but it does seem like it's a lifelong struggle. So yeah, let's talk about the lifeboat process, sort of what would happen. Sort of have us picture, also visuals, like have us picture the space, the room, and what would be happening in that space.
So it would be during a seminar called Focus, and you had to be kind of indoctrinated at that point. Like you had to be a certain level. You had to show that you were working your program to even get into the seminar, to get one step closer to going home. And I didn't want to do this. I chose out a lot because I was like, this is brainwashing. Like, this is a cult. This is crazy. And I would choose out pretty much every time. And then they finally forced me to go through it. They literally told me, this facilitator said, I don't care if you're sitting in the corner of the room the whole time staring at a wall, you're going to graduate the seminar. So then I was forced to go through it. And the lifeboat process was difficult because we were, as Alexa explained very well in the documentary, we were sleep deprived. We were food calorie deprived. We didn't know what time of the day it even was, like most of it. We were already so broken and like vulnerable at that point because of the attack therapy that they taught us. They taught, you know, these tactics where you, if you've, you know, with Synanon, you can see the game they played. That's where this came from, the attack therapy. So we were very not in a good headspace before the lifeboat process. So you would come in to the room and everyone would space out. You would keep your eyes closed. And the facilitator would tell a story about, I don't even know. It's always this, it was the same script. Basically, it was saying like, you're on a cruise and you're happy and everything's wonderful. And then, you know, it's very silent and it's very, and you finally are getting this one moment of peace where you have your eyes closed and nobody's like around you and you don't have to share anything. And then all of a sudden they yell like really loud. They're like, oh my gosh, there's an accident. And all the people staffing it will start banging on the tables. And so everyone is like, it's jarring. It's so jarring. And so, and it, I have literally like heard people scream because it's been, you know, like in a scary movie and you jump. And then they say there's a lifeboat and there are two seats on that lifeboat. And now you all have to figure out who's going to be on that lifeboat. And then you have to go around the room and you have to give someone a vote, two people a vote, but you have to do this thing with your hand where you go, you live or you die. So you have to look at someone in the face and tell them, you don't deserve to live. I vote that you die. And the worst part would be sometimes you would give someone a vote to live and then they would come right back and say, nope, you're going to die. So it was like betrayal. And then this one seminar I went through, there was someone who was staffing it and holding up a mirror when it got to the end because you had no live votes left. And you'd have to look into the mirror and say, you die to yourself. And that's the first time I looked in a mirror in, I don't even know how long, months. I had not been able to look into a mirror prior to that. So that was also, I think, part of the mind games that they did. And so then they're like, you're wrong. That's, you know, you're supposed to want to live because you could go back and tell people's families the last words that they said, messages. So you couldn't win with it, basically. And then at that point, we would have the physical exertion where it was banging towels for hours and hours on the ground. Or it would be pushing on a wall, like trying to push like a big ball of anger or a big ball of sadness, big ball of grief, like over a cliff, but you're pushing on a wall. And I've been through enough of these where I have seen, I remember one girl specifically broke her finger. I watched people get bloody noses, faint, vomit, collapse from the, not because there's such a physical exertion with barely any calories, no water pretty much. And yeah, just the no sleep. And then after that, I remember them telling me I had to bang on the floor and be like, you're mad at your dad for dying on you. And it's just dumb stuff like, and all these people. But oh, I forgot to mention during the lifeboat process, what the facilitator would do was they would stand behind certain people. And this is when they said what they said to me for the first time is, imagine you're looking at your, okay. They said, imagine you're looking at your father right now. This person here is not them. It's your father. And you're telling your father that he died for no reason and you wasted your entire life and you're like a total piece of trash and your dad had to die in place of you, but you've wasted your whole life. And now you have to like tell him to die and just dumb stuff like that. But that's what they would do when they would say those mean things about my dad. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much the gist of it. And then, of course, you'd be reborn. So it's such a cult. Like, it literally, I have so many choose out forms where I was like, this is literally a cult. And I don't even think I really knew what a cult was back then. I just had some semblance of the word. And I was like, this feels like brainwashing. This feels weird. Yeah. And then they would have us crawl around the floor like babies. And like, we were reborn as our magical child. And we'd have to write a lifeboat letter to our magical child. And I kept all of that because it was so weird. I was like, I am never getting rid. I would, because a lot of people to cope, understandably, and to forget and move on, you know, burned their had their files burned or threw everything away. And I kept everything because I was just hopeful that one day, you know, not as much as Catherine, because she was like in the program and she was like ready to do this documentary. But I did know that like I wanted one day to have proof of what they did to me.
That's really, really good. I just did a talk about forgiving and forgetting and that it's not for everyone. And I know that in order to heal, a lot of times people are told they need to forgive, but that's actually not something that should be decided by someone else. It should be decided by you if and when you want to do that. But also, if you feel that the person is deserving of it, and there are a lot of things that have to be personal decisions, but also with forgetting, there are a lot of people who are told, just get rid of, you know, all the stuff that, you know, could be a re-traumatization. And why are you holding on to these things? But sometimes it's very important to hold on to these things because it helps you really be very clear about what happened to you.
Yeah, it's evidence of what happened to you. I agree.
Right. And I think also you may have found this, that anytime you look through it, you see it through new eyes. Like as you get older, as you learn about what you deserve to a greater degree, and hopefully that'll still be going in the right direction and a good direction for you. But, and it's really interesting and it's important for some people to hold on. Also people who forgive too easily and will make it okay and, or blame themselves. Yeah. Hold on to it until you can see it for how it really is, that this is something that people did to you. But what happens in this situation, again, I hear this a lot from former cult members, so you were right that it is a cult, that people say, but what was it all for? I mean, I hear, yes, I'm crawling around and I'm barking like a dog and I'm, you know, in these sort of psychotherapy cults, I hate to even call them therapy, just like treatment, right? Teen treatment, it's not
treatment. I know what you mean. They right? They use a form of therapy that works and then they like twist it in a really weird way.
In a really weird way, right. And to what end? Like, what was the goal of this whole lifeboat experience, except really to break you down, to confuse you, make you feel like here you get to the end and still you're berated that you did it wrong? Like, what? Just leave me alone. Leave me alone.
I think their whole cell and what I experienced, because I did talk about, like, I did not get to upper levels when I was at Ivy Ridge. And I did see how it had its own set of problems. It definitely seemed psychologically and emotionally a lot more difficult than the physical abuse that I was experiencing. Not that any of it was right, but it seemed very psychologically traumatic. So the sell of this program was that your kid is a new kid. They're broken down and now they're a robot. And now they'll do whatever you say. They are afraid to break rules. They can't trust anybody. So they're not going to have any bad friends or any friends pretty much in general because they don't trust anyone anymore. All of their friends have betrayed them. And, you know, some of the survivors who were even like sexually abused, like, and even with that sexual abuse, like, okay, well now they're not going to act out sexually. Like, it's like they wanted to create this robot and it looked really good to prospective parents because it was like, we didn't have personalities. We couldn't have an image. We couldn't wear like, even like things that made us look like we liked certain things. We were just like these broken down, built back up robots who were programized. And to parents, they were like, oh, wow, these are really respectable kids. Like, they're so kind and so proper and they have such great manners. And that was their whole thing. But that only lasts so long because then the trauma, the brainwashing trauma comes and hits you. And then you question your entire existence and how you're, because that's when you really learn to question your brain. You're like, well, I just believed something that is actually was trying to manipulate and break me. Like, so it's very confusing. And so, yeah, that was really the sell, where any of these seminars, the words they said, all of this just to break us down and to make us robotic. And that was very strategic on their end and got them a lot more money, because at least for a few months, these kids could hold on and look really good to, you know, making it outside of the program. So, yeah, but that did not happen with me, as you heard. I got sent back to a different program.
Right. And what was the different program?
I went to Midwest Academy in Iowa. And yeah, I never had that moment of being robotic or being broken down, luckily, just because I resisted at Ivy Ridge. So I was just right out the gate, like, I'm mad about being sent here. I feel like I had 2 years taken from me. So I'm going to do what I want. So it made it worse with my whole personality growing up. Like, I'm really going to do what I want now. I got sent the second time to Midwest Academy and I lucked out. I was going to turn 18 in a few months. And they were like, they cut me. They were like, listen, Diana, they're like, just make level 3 and then you'll get into this 18-year-old program and you won't have to give consequence. You won't have to call people out. You won't, because I really didn't like doing that, which is why I really didn't get far at Ivy Ridge. And they're like, you don't have to call people out. You don't have to give consequences. You won't get consequences, really. You'll have freedom if you stay here. And I was like, deal. So I actually graduated the program openly defiant of the program.
That's like, so great.
Literally on the road trip that we took for graduation to get to California, I was just like doing what I wanted. I remember one of the program director's wives was like, you know, you're like, I can't remember, like gossiping or something about someone, I don't know. And I was, I remember being in the van and being like, give me a correction, I dare you. So I got to graduate being pretty defiant. Uh-huh. So lucked out. It really worked out for me in the end.
Yes, the sassiness.
Yeah, uh-huh. Life will never be as bad. It does put in perspective. Life will never be that bad for me ever again. But that's why my heart goes out to so many survivors who did go through these programs and really believe in it. And because their parents were believing in it. Everyone was believing in it. I get it. And there were times, and I will be very honest, there were times where they did start getting their hooks into me. And I did question some things. And I said, maybe I am, something's wrong with me. Maybe I do mess everything up. Maybe I'm a bad person. You know, and they'd be like, okay, no. You know? And then I just try to like manipulate to try to go home. But I do, my heart goes out to a lot of survivors who did play the game, because they have a lot to undo when we should be young adults and we should be loving and living and experiencing life.
You know, you bring up a good point. I mean, yes, you did resist so much of it, and you're still saying that it got under your skin to a certain degree. I mean, it's inevitable that that's going to happen with so much pressure around you and so much repetition of messages. I think also, yeah, playing the game, also giving consequences to others. Yeah, I'm sure that's really, really awful. A lot of people leave cultic situations feeling very guilty about how they were pushed to mistreat others. Now, they were pushed sometimes to mistreat their own children in a cult, and that stays with them.
It does. And they did talk about it in the documentary, I think, in a very heartfelt, meaningful way. And they really explained it, and that, you know, how they felt so ashamed of that person and how they couldn't, I guess, like they never wanted to revisit that. And I get it. It's probably really, really hard. And I lucked out. I didn't have any of the brainwashing really to undo. So I got to get out and experience my 20s and be a normal person in my 20s and just have friends and go out and travel the world and, you know, go to school and really do well. And I just feel so terrible for the people who had so much work to do during that time that it took away from their young adult lives even more.
Even more, right. I think, you know, also I feel for the families, the parents who unwittingly supported this, and they're some of them are truly devastated too, because everyone was deceived. But I, coming back to what you were saying about going to the second program where you were almost 18, I'm thinking back on this lifeboat experience where you're being berated for having wasted your whole life. Really? What were you, like 15, 16, 17? Like your whole life, right? Not really. But it's so such a dramatic way of saying it. And so then when you came out of these programs and were able to kind of reorient yourself to your life, how much were you able to share with your mom about what happened to you?
Oh, I was upfront from the beginning. I told her right when I saw her what was going on. I told her about that we had stopped at the top WASP man's house in Utah. And I was like, listen, you're not going to like what I'm about to tell you. You're really not going to like this. And I told her about the extravagant wealth that they literally, I mean, they could have been on a couch having grapes fed to them, like for that kind of wealth. And also, I don't know what they were thinking in taking me there, because I was, like I said, very openly against the program. So I did have to staff some seminars, you know, like in order to graduate. But, you know, I kind of was like way more lenient. Like I actually would do this thing so I didn't have to be involved. I would be the log keeper, and which also really helped because that helped me remember a lot. So I would just sit in the back of the room the whole time and just keep a log of what everybody said and what happened so that I didn't have to participate in the attack therapy and all that other horrible stuff that comes with staffing. But I told my mom everything, and it was hard. It was just so much time she suffered and so much time I suffered. And I kind of feel like now we're just two people who suffered a lot. And we're just two like souls in this earth who just had these things happen to us. And so I guess for me, I'm mad. I'll always be mad about it. I mean, when I got sent there, the first thing I said was, I'm going to sit here and not do anything and waste every penny of my mom's money. And I did. I know she wanted to help me. And I know that she got swindled, and that we're both always going to be healing from that. So, and I just this story compared to other survivors, I know a lot still don't talk to their parents. I understand that too. I do. I think everybody's entitled to let who they want in their lives. But yeah, I just feel sad thinking about what happened to us, because I don't know what we did in this life to have all these horrible things happen to us and to keep having them happen. But I will say that the second half of my life has been wonderful. I do have a relationship with my mother, and I think we came out on the other side. So that's all I would want. If a survivor does want to speak to their parent again, it's their choice. Because a lot of parents are just like, oh, get over it, you know, like kind of thing. And that's not the way to go about it. So I wish that everybody kind of gets to some form, place of healing with their family.
That'd be wonderful. I hear what you're saying, and the true sadness. And I want to go back to two things that you said. One is this idea that you were saying you were just going to sit there and waste your mom's money. And, you know, that's a really strong defiance. That's a really strong sense of self, which has probably really helped you heal and lead the way towards this better half of your life. If you're having kind of, if you're grappling with this idea of feeling deserving, I do think, if you don't mind, I'm getting a little therapist-y right now, but
love it. I love all the advice. Okay. I love it all.
So I think to, for everyone listening, to be careful about the way things get interpreted and the way you talk about them so that they're not self-damning, because you were not wasting your mom's money. They were wasting your mom's money. You were surviving. And so there's nothing you were doing wrong. And there's nothing you were doing to your mom. And so it is really good to give credit where it's due and to have it bypass you in those situations, because there's really nothing that you did. And then this idea of what did we do to bring all this to us or deserve, you know, all of these bad things to happen? What I see is that there is randomness in the world, in the universe, and it can feel cruel, but it's not at all personal. It feels very personal, but that's not its origin. At the same time, too, it sounds like what happened next was tied in with what happened. So I feel like it's not two different things. It's one thing that led into the next. So they're all connected. And so I'm hoping that the rest of your life is, I want to say, just sort of like less eventful in these ways, right?
I'll never feel as like hopeless and like trapped, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, any situation that I found myself since then trapped in, maybe it took me a minute to figure it out and realize like, oh, I'm trapped. This is like a feeling of desperation and hopelessness, and like there's no exit to get out of those situations. So I really lucked out. There were a lot of, you know, like things and people who tried to trap me, and I caught on to their game pretty fast. Some not so as fast as others, but I eventually caught on and got out, and like share that information with anyone who ever has any questions, you know, and how to leave their own situation if they feel stuck in it. So yeah, but it's never, Ivy Ridge was the blueprint for that lesson.
Yeah, right. But I'm really glad that if you're starting to feel in a situation where you're backed into a corner, or you're like, damned if you do, damned if you don't, for you to be able to go, I'm out. But it's also, you know, going back to other people having certain stories that are so tragic, you know, there have been suicides because of this, which is really people saying, I can't get out. I don't know how to get beyond this. I feel really stuck and trapped. And so all the more reason that it is so important for you to be telling your story, coming out with your story, having something on Netflix, just, you know, having this Breaking Code Silence, just where people know their options and their support. And so they never have to choose or feel like the only option is to take their own life. I'm wondering just if you can let us know what's happening on that front, because I know, you know, organizations are trying to change laws and trying to get more oversight and standards and licensure and people watching what's happening and safeguarding it. So tell us about that whole landscape, if you can.
Pretty much everyone who was in the documentary has continued the fight. And I know that they're not going to stop until every survivor, first of all, is believed and validated, but also that this doesn't happen to anyone ever again. Also, in getting our abusers held accountable. Because a lot of them were predators. It's just traumatic in general to like revisit those people and those places. And they are working very hard to have them be held accountable and also to get more oversight in these schools. So it literally, like, the outpouring of love and support, especially after the documentary, there were phone calls. I actually had a coworker, so nice of him, who somehow knew the organization that Tom Nichols, who worked in the church setting, he was, I think, a pastor at that point, but he worked at Ivy Ridge, and he wrote a letter, and he's like, this is unacceptable. Like, anyone who was involved in any way with child abuse should not be in that position. Like, I just, everybody, it was like the first time, it was like the whole universe. It was like, this is wrong. And I think, Catherine just, oh gosh, she is so good at what she does. The ending, when she quoted Thomas Houlihan and said, the abuse of a child is the business of anyone who knows about it. And now you know. And I felt like that was the wake-up call the world needed to hear for this particular situation. And I definitely felt that call to action. And a lot of people did. And I have seen people doing things for us and listening to us in a way that I had never seen before, or that I never actually thought I would ever see. But yeah, everybody, they're working really hard and we're all really supporting one another. They're such good people. And anyway, I can help survivors to talk, which is kind of like the front I've been taking with it, is having a lot of survivors reaching out to me, thanking me for telling my story. And now they want to tell their story and just really listening to them and saying, you know, I'm glad you're telling me. Thank you. I hear you. I see you. And I believe you. And I understand. So yeah, I've kind of been taking it more in an emotional level with others and also like explaining and getting the word out. But yeah, I know a lot of organizations, but especially like the documentary cast has taken on some big projects and I'm really proud of them. They are doing it. They are doing the work.
That's so cool. That's so good. It's so empowered also. And so Ivy Ridge is no longer, right? Or is it?
No.
So thank goodness. I'm really glad. But that was recent.
Well, yeah, it was because they lost, or no, I'm sorry, they didn't lose. They never had any accreditation. So they were handing out fake diplomas, which literally ruined people's lives even more. So these kids thought they graduated high school, go to college, and then find out that was a fake diploma, and then have to drop out of college, go back and get their GED. So like that school, I don't know what would, like, I swear that like land is haunted. Like it is like I don't, there's bad things that happen there. It's like the hits keep coming with Ivy Ridge. It was, yeah, they actually were handing out knowingly fake diplomas and ruining people's lives in that way.
Incredible. Wow. Okay. God, they're just so used to getting away with things. They just became so like shameless. Just, yeah, this is real. No, it's not. And I can only imagine someone who goes to college and still healing from how they were being treated. And then they have to deal with repercussions in their own life and having to start again. And oh my goodness. Wow.
I was lucky enough to not graduate from that school. I got pulled. So that did not happen to me. But the stories that I've heard from the people it did happen to breaks my heart. Because what more can they take from you? You know, it's like they gave you lifelong trauma. All of us, they gave us lifelong trauma. They gave us trust issue, abandonment issues. I mean, because we were sent away and told that nobody was going to come for us and nobody cared enough to come get us. And, you know, and people were moving on without us. And so abandonment issues, trust issues. Yeah. And then to add insult to injury, also no real education.
Right. Incredible. Incredible.
Really terrible place.
Yeah. Really, really awful. Okay. So just as we're finishing up, you know, because you had the experience of talking to your mom, and I'm sure it was hard to share all that with her, but it's so good that the two of you have each other in this very, very entwined way that you've been through so much together. Very beautiful to hear about your relationship. I'm wondering if you can give just sort of one or two thoughts about how parents should respond when their child comes out of something like this. I mean, first and foremost, I think believe your child, even if the program has told you not to and not to listen to what they're saying, especially if it's negative about the program. What else do people need when they're coming out from their families?
I think the hard part is that the parents are also still brainwashed as well. So not only are they not believed that the child, but they're not, there's no safe place. Home isn't safe anymore because now the program is in their home. And we had to, in order to go home, we had to make life contracts. And basically we were on a point system, just like the program, at home with our parents. And we had to write ourselves corrections. It is wild. So that I think really makes it hard because you both have to wake up, and it's usually not at the same time. I feel like someone will wake up before the other person, or one person might just close that book and say, I can't like revisit this. I just think for parents, it's important to listen and be supportive and, you know, really see them. And also not say things like, okay, so are we over this now? Or, okay, did you get out of your system? Or why are you still talking about this? Things like that, because this is something that's going to stay with us forever. And the difference is, yes, our parents were brainwashed, but we were children and our brains were still forming. So a lot of what happened to us is sticking with us for a very long time, whereas an adult whose brain is done forming might have a little bit more of a skill set in being able to, you know, like come out of it and say, oh, that was bad. I'm over it. Like, I'm going to move on with my life. I'm going to go back to work. I'm going to do this. So we don't have that framework of support. So, yeah, I would say just in knowing that is very important for parents.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a really important caution that before just taking from what you said, I guess the advice might be before parents adopt the techniques of the program into their own home, find out the impact that it had on your child first before you become unwittingly an abuser. And help them keep abusing themselves by giving themselves consequences, et cetera.
I think that's something a lot of us, it'll come up from time to time because I forget about it all the time, about the life contracts. I lucked out again. I didn't have one because I got home when I graduated and I pretty much, I think within the month, went straight to college. So freedom. And it was so fun. I was so happy. But yeah, these life contracts were pretty sick. You had things like A, B, C, D, and F friends. And your parents had to approve who you hung out with. If you went, I think like some of them are like, if you went on a date, and these are like 18-year-olds and 17-year-olds. If you went on a date, the parents had to be on the date with you. Like, absolutely wild. And then you were on a point system. And every night you had to have group, which is attack therapy. And you had to give each other feedback every night. So the lasting effects of being in the program do not end with the program, because for a lot of kids, it continued at home and just made it worse and just prolonged healing even longer.
Wow, that's really important that you're talking about this. I think people don't know that. Thank you. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing, for being able to kind of go through it. You know, so that you can teach about it, so you can do education and prevention and hopefully changing the future for so many people and helping people feel understood when they've been traumatized in this way. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, Diana, what you're doing is really, really powerful. Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
One more thing before you go. Oh my goodness. What a story. What a story. This is what happens when people are pushed into terrible experiences and made to feel terribly about themselves, and are indoctrinated from start to finish, and even their parents who are indoctrinated to make them feel like this is the right decision for their children. It is unconscionable to hear about all that she was put through, and it's illegal and akin to torture. Just even the psychological part of it, forgetting even about the physical part of it, that she was told she was garbage and that she should have been the one to die in the crash that killed her father. Really? Someone actually says that to somebody else? Somebody says that to a child who's lost their father. Someone says that to a child who's away from their mother, away from their family, has nowhere to go, but just to sit with those words and to sit with that accusation and to sit with being made to feel like you are worth nothing. Who does that to anyone else? And the fact that that could be seen as therapy? I mean, there is something really
not only reprehensible about it, but very sick, really pathological about it. There is a lot that people get away with under the guise of other things, under the guise of religion at times, under the guise of therapy at times. What Diana got there was nothing like therapy. And it's a shame, too. So many people who have been in these kinds of quote-unquote therapeutic situations are then afraid of therapy, thinking that it's like this, thinking that it's attack therapy. When Diana said, too, that it doesn't matter what your child did to warrant being sent to Ivy Ridge, or actually a lot of these places, it should always matter, first of all. But as we know now about these places, no child should have been sent there. She also talks about being so disoriented, not being able to be let outside for long periods of time, not being able to get enough sleep, which is disorienting, not ever knowing what time it is, highly disorienting. And then also being food deprived, which can be disorienting because sometimes people have their clocks that are set in terms of their internal clock based on when they get hungry and then when they eat. But if you're hungry really all the time, it's like being tired all the time. You lose sight of your body and what it's trying to tell you and how it's trying to help you stay on track and stay on schedule with your life. But also being food deprived is going to make you disoriented as well, because you're not getting enough nutrition, you're not getting enough protein to feed the brain, you're not getting enough food to even be able to sleep in a sound way when you are given the chance to sleep. So your whole body is in a deficit. Your whole body is compromised. She also talked about this lifeboat process where you're supposed to talk about who you would save and then people turn on each other. You know, it becomes like this situation where people will do anything they need to do to survive, and they will throw each other under the bus or out of the lifeboat in order to survive, in order to keep the people in charge healthy with them. When you're faced with that kind of situation where you have to sort of play Russian roulette with other people who you care about and undermine really yourself as a human being, doing things that are unconscionable, that are against your conscience in order to keep people okay with you, then you know the system is very sick if you are having to hurt others or at least tell people that you're going to hurt them or kill them or let them die in order for you to save yourself. I mean, it really is setting people up in a situation, and you look at it now from a distance, as I'm sure Diana can look at it from a distance and wonder why any of it felt necessary at the time, and also why and how it could ever help anyone. I remember talking to a person who had been involved in one of these teen treatment places and then got involved on a staff level. And he came to talk to me and came to get therapy because of the shame and the guilt he felt by putting people through things that he at the time was even questioning in his mind, but was able to be convinced and reconvinced was for their benefit. Because he thought it's what had saved him and saved his own life. He really realized later on that he would have kind of grown out of whatever behavior that he was doing that caused his parents to send him to one of these places. And so it wasn't the place that saved him. In fact, it's the place that harmed him. And he would have eventually just saved himself. But here he was engaging in this kind of therapy, and now the therapy he needs is to get over the kind of therapy he did with other people, because he put them through things that really pushed them up against a wall or into a corner emotionally, psychologically. And he doesn't really know to this day what any of it was good for. He only saw, and even in the moment he could see, how much people were being affected by it in a negative way,
and now wonders how much he participated in harming others. And I've worked hard to try to help him not feel that he was the source of their problems, but rather the conduit. He was doing it because he believed he had good intentions and he had right intentions, but also he was trying to protect himself. Again, showing that if you have to harm other people to protect yourself, there isn't necessarily something wrong with you, but there's something wrong with the system that's causing you to feel you don't have a choice and that it's an either-or situation for survival. There's also something important that I want to mention that Diana talked about, which is that there were lots of justifications made in her life for being mistreated. And that, she says, there is never a justification for abuse. And it goes along, I think, as Diana was talking about, with this whole tough love idea. And I remember that when I was raising my kids, there was this push to let kids cry themselves to sleep. And to a certain degree, I guess that's a good thing if kids really are having trouble learning how to self-soothe and they're in a safe environment and you've checked to make sure that they're not uncomfortable, they're not sick, they're not hungry, they're not anything, and they just need a minute to fall asleep, fine. But after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, my feeling is your child is telling you it needs you and needs something from you. And it's your job to listen, and it's your job to tend to them. There are recent ideas that have come forth about how you can't actually love your child too much. And the child who is given that kind of focus and attention, the child where they have the caregivers asking, what's wrong? And what can I do for you? Grow up to be confident, not coddled. It's another way of thinking. It's a smart way of thinking. And it's important because a lot of parents already have that as their instinct. And they're talked out of it by people who were raised a different way or have read other books where they're supposed to let their child just kind of suffer through all the moments where they're already suffering. It would be wonderful for parents to be able to be given other tools to know what to do in these moments when they're worried about their children. And for school districts and for therapists and others to be giving parents the names and numbers of these places that are going to come and kidnap their children as a viable option is so wrong, but is also so much of a leap. And what you're leaping over is just looking at your child in the eye or putting your hand on their shoulder and saying, I'm here. Talk to me. Tell me what's wrong. Tell me what you're reacting to, maybe that I'm doing. Tell me what you're reacting to that's part of your life or internally something going on for you. I want to understand. I want to be curious. I don't want to be immediately angry and punishing. I want to make it safe for you to talk. And then I wonder if these teen treatment places would be as necessary. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Unlock big savings while adding style and security to your home with Schlage door locks from Menards. controls, high-quality Schlage Wi-Fi compatible entry locks allow you to lock and unlock your home from anywhere with your phone. Get peace of mind and save big money on all door locks at Menards. Plus, don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money.